The statement of the Holy Father following these encounters are eagerly awaited.
The papal trip to Hungary, understanding the political and religious landscape of the Holy Father's three-day apostolic journey to meet political and religious leaders, the poor and refugees, and of course, the faithful, as the war in neighboring Ukraine rages on.
Because of their religious beliefs, think that their religious beliefs, they're in effect in concentration camps in China.
EWTN News In Depth sits down with the U.S. Ambassador to the Holy See. Joe Donnelly is on the record about Ukraine, diplomacy, and American priorities.
There are people around the world who are targeted for persecution and for death because of what they believe, because of their religious commitments.
The so-called forgotten genocide. The repercussions continue today, more than a century after 1.5 million people were wiped out in Armenia. EWTN News In Depth starts now. A celebratory welcome for the Holy Father as he meets Hungarian officials at Sandor Palace in Budapest. A visit dominated by Russia's war in Ukraine, migration flows, and Hungary's tense relations with Brussels. Welcome to EWTN News In Depth. I'm Montse Alvarado. The Holy Father did not shy away from reiterating church stances on immigration, gender ideology, and more. We'll get to his first speech in a moment. But first, we look at the significance of this trip, especially since his last visit 2 years ago was so brief. From the EWTN News Vatican Bureau, Rudolf Gehrig explains.
Almost 2 years have passed since Pope Francis last visited Hungary. On September 12, 2021, the pontiff came to Budapest for just 7 hours. At that time, the 52nd International Eucharistic Congress was held in the capital of Hungary. However, Pope Francis promised to come again.
It's seen as the promised trip. And for the Hungarian people, it is the opportunity to properly introduce their country to the Pope with all its reality, all its aspects that their local church has and their culture.
He is fulfilling that promise this weekend. Christ is our future is the motto of the pontiff's 41st apostolic journey.
As Hungarians, we would like to believe that he simply likes the Hungarians. And I have some ground to say that, because when I met him for the first time, he told me that he knows everything about Hungary. Then I
asked him, Eduard Habsburg is Hungary's ambassador to the Holy See. He says that Russia's war against Ukraine has a direct impact on the neighboring country of Hungary. Refugees from Ukraine are trying to get to Hungary and from there to the European Union. The Pope is meeting with refugees on Saturday at the Church of St. Elizabeth in Budapest. Afterwards, Pope Francis visits the Greek Catholic community in the neighboring Church of the Protection of the Blessed Virgin Mary.
I think when you come to Hungary, you will notice a strong living together of the different Christian churches. You have a Calvinist presence. You have within the Catholic Church, you have a strong presence of the Greek Catholics. They are very visible. They are about 300,000 faithful. We have three bishops. You have the probably strongest and most vibrant Jewish community in Europe.
The Hungarian diplomat also says Hungary and the Holy See have a common goal.
I'm very aware that the Pope knows about our activities for persecuted Christians worldwide. We are all over the world helping Christians, but it's a personal project that is very close to the heart of our Prime Minister, but it's also something that goes with Hungarian identity. We see ourselves as a Christian nation since 1,000 years. And so it's something we simply do. We help other Christians.
The last time Pope Francis met with Prime Minister Viktor Orban was last April in the Vatican. Their meeting is scheduled for Friday, as is his meeting with Hungary's first female president, Katalin Novak, who visited him in Rome last August. She described their encounter as indeed a very inspiring meeting. Like Orban, she is not Catholic. However, both publicly profess their Calvinist faith. A youth meeting in the Laszlo Pop Sports Arena is scheduled for Saturday. It can accommodate more than 200,000 people. The fact that Pope Francis stayed in Hungary for only 7 hours in 2021 was interpreted by some political experts as Pope Francis's rejection of Orban's migration policies, which were criticized by many European observers. But the war in Ukraine has perhaps created a desire for cooperation.
This visit will be held just a few hundreds kilometers away from the Ukrainian borders, in the very sensitive context of the conflict between Ukraine and Russia. So it is considered a very highly symbolic trip.
After the Russian invasion, there are only two voices in Europe that strongly advocate for peace, for immediate ceasefire and peace negotiations. That is Hungary and the Holy See.
A big reason this papal visit to Hungary will be watched so closely around the world. From Rome, Rudolf Gerich, EWTN News in depth.
As Rudolf explained, Prime Minister Viktor Orban is known for his hard line on migration, and the Holy Father, as we know, has made welcoming migrants a cornerstone of his papacy. Pope Francis took the opportunity in his initial speech to condemn the ideologies of war, as well as urged Hungary and the rest of Europe to help those suffering from the fallout of the violence.
Many of our brothers and sisters who flee in desperation from conflicts, poverty, and climate change, we feel bound to confront the problem without excuses and delay. It needs to be confronted together, as a community, not least because, in the present situation, its effects will be felt sooner or later by all of us.
Francis went on to condemn supranationalism that he said loses sight of the life of its people. During his initial talk, the Holy Father also condemned forms of ideological colonization, including gender theory and abortion, that he says is masked by a sense of progress. Francis also praised Hungary for promoting family values. EWTN will be providing full coverage this weekend of the Pope's visit to Hungary, his pastoral and political encounters, and public celebrations of the faith across our cable, digital, and social media platforms. Showing no signs of stopping, Pope Francis says he plans to visit his homeland, Argentina, in 2024. The remarks were in the Argentinian daily La Nación on Sunday. The trip would mark the first time the Holy Father would return home since becoming pontiff 10 years ago. The 86-year-old Pope did not provide any further details about the potential trip. Thousands of demonstrators flooded the streets throughout Argentina last week, protesting against the country's economic policies. They carried lit torches and flares as they marched to the president's office in Buenos Aires, demanding financial help. Argentina is in the middle of its worst economic crisis in more than 30 years, with inflation rates surging past 100%. The crisis has led to a political upheaval. President Alberto Fernández announced last Friday that he will not run for re-election. Presidential elections will be held this fall. Argentinians are no doubt facing major issues right now. The chairman of the Criterio Foundation, that houses the oldest Catholic magazine in Buenos Aires, and the former ambassador of Argentina to the Holy See, Vicente Espejel, joins us now to discuss the significance of a papal trip to Argentina. It's so wonderful to have you here, Ambassador. Pope Francis said he would visit next year, that is, after the presidential election. He avoids any political undertones to his visit. Do you think this is intentional?
Of course. First of all, let me tell you that we are thrilled with the visit of the Pope. It's really a great, great, great news for us. We have been waiting for that for all his pontificate for 13 years. And he is also very happy to come. I understand perfectly well why he did not come before. It's not easy for many people to understand, but he has his priorities as Pope, and the priorities were communities elsewhere where the Pope had never been before. Now, with regards to his visit to Argentina, we are definitely thrilled and waiting for him. He's going to be facing a new government in Argentina, mm-hmm. because we have elections in October. And it's going to be a boost for whoever comes as a president and a new government in Argentina. He will find a field hospital in his own country, certainly, because the economy is running very badly. We had drought, and we have lots of problems. We are going to be facing a better future once the oil, more oil and lithium will be produced in a short time. So that's going to be helping us. But of course, we had a very, very high inflation. So the Pope's visit is going to be a great boost for us in Argentina, definitely.
And Ambassador, how has the sex abuse crisis, which is this global crisis for the church, and the crises with local priests in Argentina affected participation and affiliation with the church for the faithful in Argentina?
I don't think that we have an exceptional case more serious than the rest of the world. I think that we are following the trend. It's an awful trend, certainly. But I don't think that we are sort of a record of excesses in this field. Of course, it is awful, and we are all very sorry about it. And I'm sure that the church is doing everything it can to avoid this thing and change the policies that used to be used decades ago, and they were wrong, certainly.
Well, we'll be looking out to see what Pope Francis says. He has a tendency to bring heartfelt apologies with him. What will this visit then mean for Catholics in Argentina?
Well, it's part of our pride, national pride, that the Pope is a world Pope, and we're going to have it for us for a few days. So we are really, really very, very thrilled about his visit, looking forward for it, and praying for him, and we are sure that it's going to be a great visit for us, and I hope it's going to be a great visit for him too.
Yes, we're praying for him on that. One last question, just about this global process we're all in as a universal church, the Synod on Synodality. How is this particularly special or significant for the people of Argentina?
I think we should remember what happened with John Paul II when he decided in the turn of the century that every continent should have his synod. He decided that America should have one synod for all America. I think that this was one of the signs of the times, and I think that we should follow that approach to enhance the relations between churches of North America and Latin America. And in that sense, I think that universities, the Catholic universities of the region, both North and South, should work more together. For instance, in a subject like the doctrine of the church in international relations, which is a part of the social doctrine of the church, but it is something that deserves special attention. And we have many, many reasons why in North and South America, we should work more together as a church in that field in particular.
A church that's universal. Thank you so much, Ambassador.
Thank you.
This summer, Pope Francis will be traveling to Portugal to help celebrate World Youth Day in the city of Lisbon. We're less than 100 days away from the multi-day event, which kicks off on August 1st. Thousands of volunteers are needed to make it a success. The Holy Father knows that the diocese and the city are working hard to prepare for the event that is expected to attract hundreds of thousands of youth from around the world. He took a moment to thank them for their efforts ahead of World Youth Day.
I'd like to greet you Lisboners who are working so hard to prepare this youth meeting. I'm happy to be back to Lisbon, to Portugal. I'm happy with what you are doing, and forgive me for the trouble that it will bring you. Thank you for being so welcoming.
World Youth Day will be from August 1st to the 6th. EWTN will be bringing you live broadcast coverage, plus unique perspectives and stories on all of our media platforms. Be sure to tune in and follow EWTN on our social media sites to see that coverage and more right in the palm of your hand. Still to come on EWTN News In Depth, one of the strictest abortion bans in the country signed into law. We have the latest in the continued battle for life across the country.
But what is peace? Peace is something that provides justice and is durable. And peace is not having half your country taken and then you go, okay, let's call it a day.
an exclusive interview with America's ambassador to the Holy See. His insights on the role the U.S. and Vatican can strive for together to help war-torn Ukraine. And ahead, desperate to escape before their country plunges into civil war, the humanitarian crisis in Sudan.
This is not a time to be complacent. That's why I'm running for re-election.
He's officially in the running. This week, President Joe Biden announced in a video message that he will be a candidate again for President of the United States. In his first public remarks as a 2024 candidate, he spoke to union allies in Washington, telling them his economic plan is working and he wants voters to let him, quote, finish the job. President Biden, while the second Catholic president in our nation's history, is known to promote policies that are not in accord with Catholic teaching. If current polling holds, it appears President Biden could be headed towards a rematch with former President Donald Trump. The man President Biden selected to represent the United States at the Holy See has been on the job in Rome for a little over a year. Like the president, former Indiana Senator Joe Donnelly is an Irish Catholic with a tradition of faith in his family. Our correspondent Colin Flynn spoke to him about U.S. priorities at the Vatican, his diplomatic role, and how he balances American political policies that do not always align with Catholic Church teaching. Here's Ambassador Joe Donnelly on the record.
Ambassador Donnelly, it is great to be with you, and thank you for having us here in your residence.
Well, thank you very much, and it's not mine. It belongs to the people of the United States. I tell guests, they say, we really like your home, and I say, well, I own 1/330,000,000th of it, is what I do.
But you're enjoying your small ownership of it at the moment.
Yes, I am.
When you met Pope Francis and you presented him with your credentials, what was that moment like? Was there anything that the Pope said to you?
Well, it was special for a number of reasons. Seeing this person who, I mean, he's the Pope, and you don't ever expect to meet the Pope, right? But his humility, his kindness, his focus on those in need, on the poor, and on those who need shelter. I mean, that is so core to who he is. But the other part is, we spent about 40 minutes talking, and about 35 minutes of it was on Ukraine.
On Ukraine.
And the Pope said, you're here at a really hard time. And I said, look, here's how we view this in the United States, that Ukraine is fighting for their very survival, that if they lose, they're gone. And so when you see a mom and dad in Ukraine and the mom and children are on a train or a bus to Italy, where we have over 100,000 refugees here, and the dad stays behind to try to save his country, this is as real as it gets, because we're, about a two-hour plane ride away from this. The Pope was praying for the people of Ukraine, and I think if you've heard him speak about it recently, where he's talked about Ukraine has a right to their own destiny, has a right to their own freedom, it's pretty powerful.
And at Easter, he said he wished that the light of Easter would be shone on the Russian people as well. And when you're in that setting with the Holy Father and you're talking about Ukraine, are you talking about ways you can more work together to bring about peace, or is he encouraging the United States to help them more with that?
How can we work together so that the people of Ukraine can be safe? I mean, you look at the atrocities that have been committed, the people who have been murdered and slaughtered and raped, and it goes on every day today, that what the Russians are doing, that the Pope is wondering, how can we work together to end this? And so that's what we as a nation, the United States, tries to do every day, is to say, how can we help Ukraine to survive and to end this slaughter?
And it's great, those strong points where the Holy See and the United States can work together, like bringing about peace in Ukraine, the environment. Is it difficult in other senses to be the U.S. ambassador to the Holy See when you look at policies from the United States government, like around issues of abortion or LGBTQ issues, things that Pope Francis himself calls gender ideologies? when they're directly opposed to the teachings of the Catholic Church. Is that a difficult position to be in?
No, because if you look at it historically, there's always been issues that the Church and the United States don't agree on. But we agree on so many more things than we disagree on. We work together all the time. We work on many issues all the time. We're very honest with each other, too, that we don't agree on everything. But on the things we do agree on, how can we make the world a better place?
Does it come up sometimes, the as much as the things you do agree on, but the things you don't agree on, are they kind of trashed out a bit? Or
not too much, for this reason, that my job here is, my work is primarily in the foreign policy area. And many of those issues, while very important, are not in those areas. That my job is to work on issues regarding other, like Ukraine, or religious freedom in China, or how do we make sure that we can help provide better health care throughout the world, because the Catholic Church provides almost 25% of health care in the world. Those are the kind of things that we work on here. Many of those other issues that you talk about are not so much in my portfolio.
You mentioned religious freedom in China.
Yes.
And you just think of persecuted Christians, not just in China, but in places like Nigeria, Nicaragua, many places all around the world happening today. Such an important issue for not just the Catholic Church, but for anyone who believes in religious freedom. Is that something that, as an ambassador, that you are focused on trying to tackle?
Yeah, it is actually core to our work. We have we've had a number of representatives from our government come over here to talk to the Vatican about various religious freedom subjects. One in particular met with the Vatican on the situation for the Uyghurs, where they're in concentration camps in China because of their religious beliefs. I think that their religious beliefs, they're in effect in concentration camps in China. And then persecution of Christians and Catholics in China as well. And then you talk about other parts of the world. So our mission here very much includes the mission of making sure there is religious freedom.
What can be done, do you think, to help these persecuted Christians more? By people like the United States and the Catholic Church?
To have a strong voice at every turn, to stand with those who are being persecuted, as opposed to standing with the bullies who are giving them a bad time.
Do you think enough has been done now?
Well, we can always do more.
Mm-hmm. And interestingly, actually, with them, we talk about religious freedom, and we see Christianity decline in many parts of the Northern Hemisphere anyway, and many democracies turning their back kind of on religious values. Do you think there is a place for religious beliefs in politics?
Well, I think it's at the core of almost everything we see, even if someone's not in a church on a Sunday. They still have core values that they learned that help to guide what they do, that the things that are important of making sure that people have a place to stay, that children can be fed, that rights are respected. Those are all religious values. Those are all values that Jesus taught us. And so those are the kind of things that I think people learn in their core.
And in the United States, it still does drive so many voters when they go in to that ballot box to mark it, doesn't it, their faith?
It does. When you look, their values are the values that come from their faith.
Final question, Ambassador. Your mother who passed away when you were only 10, or your father who worked so hard to provide for the 5 children, what would they think now if they saw you here as the ambassador for the United States to the Holy See?
They'd think that they showed up at the wrong place. They'd say, don't you, you're like the guy who's out on the street cleaning up. I mean, we always laugh about that look, they just worked so hard. My siblings and I were the first generation to ever go to college. And for something like this, it's like, Joe represents the United States? My dad would go
to the Pope.
What happened? But, he always imbued his faith in us. And the credo was work hard, do what's right. And it all works out. And so I feel incredibly blessed because I represent, you know, sometimes I think it's like I represent from Maine to Oregon, from California to Florida. And so I feel a responsibility to make sure I do that right every day.
Ambassador Joe Donnelly, it was great talking
Thank
to you.
Thank you very, very
Thank
much.
You very much.
Thank you.
There was much more of Colum's interview with Ambassador Donnelly. You can watch their entire conversation on the EWTN YouTube page. The week's top news stories are coming up after the break, including the papal meeting with the Prime Minister of Ukraine. More than 400 people dead and 4,000 injured in Sudan. International embassies evacuated. Thousands of civilians are making frenzied efforts to escape as the deadly violence between the Sudanese armed forces and a paramilitary group escalates. News about a potential civil war in Sudan tops the week in review. There's no end in sight in the clashes between the army and rapid support forces that began earlier this month. Several ceasefires have been ignored as the two groups, who were once allies, each vie for control. Shelling, rockets, gun battles, and sniper fire have wreaked havoc in several regions of the African country, including its capital, Khartoum. Humanitarian and aid groups have been attacked and looted. City streets are left deserted. Rockets and shells have rained down on homes, businesses, hospitals, and even churches. A rocket hit a priest's house and the front gate of the Cathedral of Mary, Queen of Africa Church on April 20th in El Obeid Diocese south of Khartoum. Luckily, no one was hurt, but there is a lot of damage. There are also reports of gun violence in Omdurman. Thousands of Sudanese are fleeing the capital of Khartoum to other, safer regions of the country. Desperate people are paying high prices to get out quickly by bus or car. Otherwise, they're left to walk. Many are heading to neighboring countries. Sudan is bordered by seven countries, most of which are already rife with poverty, food insecurity, instability, and inundated with refugees. According to the United Nations, Sudan is now in a catastrophic humanitarian situation as access to food, shelter, and medicine is threatened. The United States Embassy staff and their families were evacuated last weekend by U.S. military helicopters manned by elite Navy SEAL commandos. Multiple other countries also evacuated their embassy personnel. But there will be no coordinated evacuation for the roughly 16,000 American citizens remaining in Sudan because of the complexity and danger of travel. Many of them are dual nationals who have not expressed a desire to leave. The international community, including Pope Francis, is calling for peace.
Auspico che l'impegno per la cura del creato.
Unfortunately, the situation in Sudan remains grave. Thus, I am renewing my appeal so that violence ceases as soon as possible and that the path of dialogue resumes. I invite you all to pray for our Sudanese brothers and sisters.
Another region suffering from war, Ukraine. On Thursday, Pope Francis met with Ukraine's Prime Minister Denis Shmyhal. The Pope has been outspoken in his support for Ukraine since the Russian invasion last year. It's the first known meeting between the two since the start of the war. They held a private audience for about a half hour to discuss peace efforts before exchanging gifts. Francis gave a plaque of a flower engraved with the words, "Peace is a fragile flower." Shmyhal gave a ceramic rooster that survived a bombing, along with grain from Ukraine and a book with images of the ongoing war. In a news conference, the prime minister says he asked Pope Francis to help retrieve Ukrainian children that he says were forcibly taken to Russia.
I asked His Holiness to help us return home Ukrainians. Ukrainian children who were detained, arrested, and were criminally deported to Russia. And I also invited His Holiness to visit Ukraine personally.
Pope Francis has said he would like to visit Kyiv, but only if he could also visit Moscow, going to both cities to promote dialogue and peace. In the United States, the future long-term use of the abortion drug mifepristone remains uncertain after a much-awaited announcement late last week from the Supreme Court. In the High Court's first major abortion-related decision since overturning Roe v. Wade last summer, the justices put on hold a lower court's ruling banning mifepristone. As is common in emergency cases, the majority did not explain its reasoning. But Justices Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito both dissented. The case brought by a group of pro-life medical associations against the FDA will now be heard by the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. Legal observers say whatever the outcome, the full case will likely end up on appeal back at the Supreme Court. In the meantime, the justices' decision last week means mifepristone will remain available nationwide under current FDA regulations. In response, the lead counsel for the plaintiffs, Eric Baptist of the Alliance Defending Freedom, issued this statement. Our case seeking to put women's health above politics continues on an expedited basis in the lower courts. The FDA must answer for the damage it has caused to the health of countless women and girls and the rule of law by failing to study how dangerous the chemical abortion drug regimen is and unlawfully removing every meaningful safeguard, even allowing for mail-order abortions. We look forward to a final outcome in this case that will hold the FDA accountable. The legal battle on the abortion pill reversal law in Colorado continues. Colorado Governor Jared Polis signed a law prohibiting healthcare workers from prescribing abortion pill reversing medication on April 14th. The same day, a lawsuit was filed by Bella Health and Wellness, a Catholic healthcare clinic, on grounds of religious discrimination. The medication uses progesterone to reverse the effects of the abortion pill mifepristone. A federal judge issued a 14-day restraining order on the law as it applies to Bella Health and Wellness, allowing it to continue serving women who wish to reverse their chemical abortions. The current restraining order expires on Friday, April 28th. It's unclear when the judge will issue a ruling in the case and whether or not the request for a permanent injunction will be granted. The state of North Dakota now has one of the strictest abortion bans in the country. Governor Doug Burgum signed legislation on Monday banning abortion in nearly all cases. The law prohibits all abortions after 6 weeks of pregnancy. Before 6 weeks, only women or girls subject to rape, incest, or suffering from certain medical emergencies would be allowed to terminate their pregnancies. The law goes into effect immediately despite a ruling from the state Supreme Court blocking another ban on abortion in the state and while a lawsuit over its constitutionality proceeds. Catherine Lopez, a senior fellow at the National Review Institute and editor-at-large of National Review, has written extensively on abortion throughout the country. Thanks so much for coming back on our program, Catherine. In the case about regulating abortion we just mentioned in Colorado and in North Dakota, we're seeing two ends of the spectrum here. Do you think that states will eventually come around to some kind of middle ground?
I think what you're seeing is how it's going to play out. In states like North Dakota, where there's more of a consensus that abortion is not a good, you're going to see the ban like we see there. Other places, it's going to be impossible. I mean, I'm coming to you from New York. Our governor wants to continue to expand abortion. Our mayor wants to give out free abortion pills, is doing so. And so this is what we're going to see play out. You know, I think last June, when the Supreme Court overturned Roe versus Wade, there was a sense that this somehow was, at least in the media, that this was the end of abortion, right? No, not at all. And now part of the debate you're seeing play out is, so is this really a state's issue for the long term? If it's a state's issue, what is that supposed to look like? If you're a pro-lifer, what are you supposed to be supporting? Now, the fact of the matter is, if you believe abortion is wrong, we want no abortions in America, but we're a far cry from there. And Nikki Haley, who's running for president, gave a speech that made a lot of good points this week, where she talked about the importance of changing the culture. She talked beautifully about her husband, who was adopted, who came from a very broken situation where the birth parents really couldn't care for him, and the importance of talking about that and really working to change the culture, because there are states like Colorado where you're never going to be able to pass a law like North Dakota was until you do a lot of work. And pro-lifers need to be praying, especially Catholics, you know, especially prayers for prudence, compassion, and courage from politicians, because there are a lot of Republicans who don't want to be touching this.
That's right.
And don't want to be, certainly don't want to go to 6-week ban territory. But of course, we know that's when the heartbeat is present. Right. And so that seems like the humane thing to do. But there are states where you're not going to be able to do that right now.
Well, let's talk about that issue before you tell us that. Knowing that life begins in the womb, we know that. Can Catholics support incremental limits to abortion? It sounds like you're saying that, but let's get right to the heart of that question.
Yeah, absolutely. And no one was more pro-life than Cardinal O'Connor in New York, who founded the Sisters of Life. And he talked about the fact that in good conscience, Catholics can vote for incremental measures. The fact of the matter is, if you're going to be preventing abortions where you weren't preventing abortions at all right, we're making progress. But we also have to be clear, this isn't enough. You can't just check that box and say we're done in whatever state we're in. No, there's more work that has to be done. But if you are saving lives, the incremental approach is okay. There's no moral reason that you can't do that, unless, you know, if the politician is making clear, look, I'm placating you people. All right, well, that's a debate we have to have with that politician. Still, it may be possible to vote for the law in whatever given state. This is time for prudence. And also, I think there's something to be said. My colleague at National Review, Ramesh Panur, has written consistently and clearly about this. I don't know that pro-lifers can have litmus tests for primary candidates, because again, depending on what state you're in, there are certain things you're going to be able to get away with and certain things you're not going to be able to get away with. I mean, think about a state like Michigan, where pro-lifers were said to have lost. Well, you've got a governor who is avidly pro-abortion. And pro-abortion is the right word. I don't use that for everyone who considers themselves pro-choice, but she is. And the other thing, quickly, Monsi, that I think we need to be weary of is the media declaring that every election where pro-lifers seem to lose is you know, proof that being opposed to abortion is a losing issue. If you look at the midterm elections, there were governors like Mike DeWine won by like 25 points. And there were a couple other examples of Republican governors who were clearly pro-life, supported restrictions after Roe, didn't lose by a lot. And so be wary. We are going to lose elections in part because of that, and we have to be okay with that as well. But it is not the loser that the media portrays it as.
That's right. It's all part of bringing up this discussion again into the public square. Really quick, last question for you, Catherine. You talked about Nikki Haley and abortion being a huge topic in the presidential race. Will there be any efforts to help women aside from making sure that we are allowed to have birth in our country? What happens next?
Well, this is the critical thing. There hasn't been a lot of media attention on Texas and the supports that they had as part of their protecting unborn human life. Lynn Fitch in Washington last week at the Heritage Foundation talked about how in Mississippi, not only did they, you know, overturn Roe versus Wade for us, but have all these supports for women, including, you know, simple things that everyone should be able to support. An app for a woman who's pregnant. What are my resources? What are my options? And Nikki Haley spoke to this a lot in her speech. We have to make clear that we are for women and babies and flourishing. And pushing abortion is not good for women. Women deserve better. This has been a constant theme of the pro-life movement. And we also have to tell the stories, as you do, thank you, Monsi, about people on the front lines who really accompany women, because the pro-life movement is a movement of love.
Well, Catherine, it looks like we're going to have a lot to continue tracking, both at the state level, but also with these cases going back up to the Supreme Court. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Monsi.
destroying the Armenians in every way possible, including culturally, such that it razed almost all vestiges of Armenian identity and Armenian culture.
The massacres and starvation of a people a century ago is remembered at this time every year. What we can learn from history and how it's impacting tensions in Armenia today.
This week marked a somber anniversary that you might not be familiar with. Armenian Genocide Remembrance Day occurs every year on April 24th to commemorate the start in 1915 of the killing and starvation of 1.5 million Armenians. But what might seem like a distant memory for some has current impact, parallels, and warning signs today. Reporter Mark Irons explains.
Roses laid together for a people brutally dispersed. Prayers from ancient Christianity commemorate the massive loss of life.
The Armenian Genocide was the destruction of the Armenian people, which was a minority within the Ottoman Empire.
In 1915, the Ottoman Empire, in what is now modern-day Turkey, began persecuting some of its own people, Armenians. They were believed to be a threat to the government's goal of a modern, unified Turkey.
The main problem was difference within the empire, and it had to get rid of difference.
Elisa von Judenforgi, co-founder of the Lemkin Institute for Genocide Prevention, says the Holocaust provides a reference point. Just as Nazi Germany saw Jews as a threat to power,
so too the Ottoman state began to develop this idea of the Armenians as an untrustworthy, treasonous group at the heart of the empire.
What followed included forced marches, starvation, rape, and murder. Estimates conclude around 1.5 million Armenians were killed. And this week marks 108 years since the genocide began. Helping lead the commemoration at the Embassy of Armenia in Washington, D.C., Armenian Orthodox Archbishop Vikin Akazyan, who had a warning.
Be careful. The same thing could happen anywhere in any part of the world unless you prevent the genocide.
Prevention can be challenging when some won't even admit it happened. This anniversary marks another year gone by without the Turkish government acknowledging the Armenian genocide. Throughout the years, it has maintained a crime was not carried out by former officials.
We don't hate the Turks, but we want them to acknowledge a reality.
And the U.S. just caught up, for years not recognizing it as genocide, the deliberate destruction of a particular group. There was fear of injuring diplomatic relations with Turkey. Last year, President Joe Biden became the first president in U.S. history to formally define it, writing in a statement, the Armenian Genocide, one of the worst mass atrocities of the 20th century. David Mandel Anthony, a U.S. State Department official in the Office of Global Criminal Justice, shared more.
It was very important to us as the U.S. government to ensure that we applied sort of the proper gravity.
So Dr. von Judenforgi says recognition of the crime is significant. It's also important to recognize the specific reasons it was carried out.
The genocide destroyed not only lives, but tried to abolish the very identity of a minority people. For Armenians, their Christian faith was central to that identity.
It wasn't just ethnic cleansing, it was a persecution of Christians. Going all the way back to the start of the 4th century, Armenia was the first nation to adopt Christianity as its official religion. And in modern-day Armenia, a territory established after the genocide to the east of Turkey and west of Azerbaijan, the majority of citizens remain Christian.
Modern thinkers and modern political movements were...
With a background in political philosophy, Nathan Pinkowski, the director of academic affairs with the Zephyr Institute, has studied how and why political ideas are put into action. Looking at the historically Muslim Ottoman Empire, by 1915, Pinkowski sees a government with a more modern, secular society in mind for its future. Standing in opposition, Armenians, people defined by their ancient Christian faith.
People defined by a particular religion, and that people, that religious people being destroyed. And I think this is a more accurate way to characterize what happened in the Armenian case.
Pinkowski believes it's important to acknowledge faith as central to identity, especially as we look at foreign affairs.
It's already the case within our foreign policy elite that they tend not to think of the world in terms that are attentive to these theological issues.
For his part, U.S. State Department official David Mandel Anthony says he's not attempting to remove faith-based identity from the understanding of any society.
In fact, understanding the role of faith and the role of religion in a society is indispensable to understanding conflicts and to the harm that is often suffered by civilians.
Which leads us to the present day. Archbishop Aykazyan and Dr. Fonyudin Forgy are both expressing concern about recent escalations over a disputed territory between Armenia and Azerbaijan. They believe threats from Azerbaijan, backed by Turkey, could lead to another genocide of Armenians.
What is lacking currently is the international community speaking with one voice to Turkey and Azerbaijan and making it clear that genocide will not be tolerated and that these threats need to stop.
Mark Irons, EWTN News in depth.
As Mark said, the often called forgotten genocide continues to have an impact on Armenian culture, politics, and spirituality today. Joining us to discuss the implications for modern Armenia and the Near East at large is Lara Sitrakian. Lara is the president of the Applied Policy Research Institute. She joins us from Armenia's capital city. Lara, thank you for being here. Although this is a somber occasion, how would you characterize the threats to Armenia and the Armenian-majority enclave of Artsakh, a nation of 3 million people? How would you characterize those threats today?
It's an extremely dangerous time for Armenians, for Armenia, and for the Armenian church, frankly. Roughly 120,000 Armenians who live in Nagorno-Karabakh, known as Artsakh to Armenians, are basically stranded. They've been cut off from the outside world, left to a very, very small trickle of humanitarian aid. We don't know what's going to happen next to them. There's a serious risk of ethnic cleansing. There's already concerns from the U.S. State Department and many other international actors of a humanitarian catastrophe, and no clear way to ratchet that down. There have been calls for Azerbaijan to open the roads going in and out of Nagorno-Karabakh and to allow for free movement, but those have not been heeded. It's almost more than 5 months now, I believe, that is now in effect. So a sense of helplessness, and for the mothers, for the children who live there, absolute deprivation, trauma. For those here in Armenia proper, serious fears of a new war, and that manifests in many ways. This week there were bomb threats at well over a dozen schools here in Yerevan, including the school that my children go to, with significant accompaniments of hate mail and anti-Armenian propaganda, presumed to be coming traced from across the border in Azerbaijan. And that makes life here very frightening. Freedom of worship at the churches in Nagorno-Karabakh has been severely limited. Access to some of our oldest monasteries has been extremely limited. So if you're an Armenian today, it's not exaggerating to say that you feel the weight of the Armenian genocide a century ago, but you also feel very much at risk and very much a target. And that is very difficult to bear.
It sounds unbearable. This week's anniversary takes place against the backdrop of these renewed threats from Armenia's neighbor, Azerbaijan. How does the memory of the genocide inform how Armenians see these threats that you just described today?
Well, I think it has two different ways of impacting life here. On one hand, there's a serious fear of what comes next. And as you can imagine, a deep intergenerational trauma that it's like muscle memory. When we do feel intimidation or discrimination from Turkey or Azerbaijan after such a long history of destruction and persecution, it raises the level of anxiety immediately. These are wounds that have not healed. On the other hand, it was faith that got Armenians through many years of tragedy. I can say so in my family. I know how scripture and faith and religious practice, the church, the call to even love one's enemies, all these things have motivated us to keep going and to keep building our lineage, our civilization. And so I think for many Armenians, we also feel an incredible capacity, I wouldn't even say for resilience, but for faith, for the ability to hold on to what we believe in, to stay who we are, to hold on to our unique Christian heritage, and to persist even when we can't see what's coming around the corner. And that's very Armenian. That's a very Armenian experience, something that my generation never expected to have to endure. But now that we're seeing it in the context of renewed threats of war from Azerbaijan, continued hate speech from the president of Azerbaijan, and frankly, very overt threats on their part to take pieces of Armenia by force or otherwise, very explicitly saying so, when we take those seriously, those assertions and those claims. In the past 6 to 8 months, those have intensified. We've seen not only incursions into Armenian territory from Azeri troops, but also, again, from straight from the top, from the president of Azerbaijan, claims that this country rightfully belongs to them and they're going to come back and take it for, at any cost. And so that's rhetoric that conditions this region for war instead of peace.
And it does.
We hope for the
you.
Best. We pray for them, but we do, you know, we do know that there could be danger around the corner.
Absolutely. And that's where that memory of the danger influences your response. You mentioned something that was beautiful on the spirituality, the way that this affects your spirituality. Armenians are very creative people, and this creativity is something that is invigorated and has invigorated the culture in country, but also in the diaspora where a lot of Armenians have gone. What gives them hope today?
So much. The example of our ancestors, even your question gave me goosebumps. We think of what our ancestors endured. They went through so much. They got back on their feet. They left their ancestral homes, driven out into the desert, barefoot and hungry. Their neighbors, their kind neighbors, Lebanese, Syrian, many others, took them in, gave them a chance to start over. We're so blessed and we're so fortunate compared to what they went through. And I think that gives all of us hope. Those stories of survival give all of us hope. But also, frankly, for many of us, it's the cross, it's scripture, it's looking at the illuminated manuscripts here in Armenia and around the world and in museums around the world that survived for hundreds of years. Craftsmanship, you mentioned culture, it really is true. And when we hear our music, when we see our dance, when we experience Easter every year, always in Armenia, Easter is a huge uplifting experience. It's communal, it's a real communal moment, salvation and hope. And these things are very real for us. These are not just symbols and they're not just rhetoric. They are our lived experience of being on planet Earth. Armenians are people who have gotten used to carrying the cross in their own way, in their own context. So when we can go back to rituals and to practice and to faith, it's very real for us and it animates our lives and it gives us real examples to follow. And that is what we have held on to at great cost to ourselves. It would have been far easier on many occasions to blend into our region and to give up right. our lineage and our church. And that's just not what our ancestors were interested in doing. So we follow their lead.
Well, it's a fantastic lesson for all of us to learn as we commemorate this important, horrific moment, but also have hope in the future for Armenia and the Armenian people. Thank you so much, Lara.
It's an honor. Thank you for having me.
Up next, major changes to the Synod on Synodality, the historic expansion of roles to non-religious Catholics, that and more when we return.
A historic decision to allow lay people to vote in the Synod on Synodality. The Vatican announced Wednesday that 50% of the lay people will be women, and they will be appointed directly by the Pope. Also included will be several young people. Representation among religious will also change from historically 10 members of men's religious orders to be replaced by 5 religious women and 5 religious men. The first of the two-part synod gathering will take place in Rome this October. The papal trip to Hungary underway right now is also historic. Before we leave you today, we'd like to take one more look at the start of the Pope's apostolic journey. I'm Montse Alvarado. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time, same place. Please enjoy the Pope's welcome to Hungary in this week's Images of the Week.